The Outspoken Cyclist podcast is supported by the Dodd Camera Company. An Ohio institution in photography for over 100 years, Dodd Camera has stayed right in step with the newest in digital cameras and accessories, as well as offering services such as photo restoration and large format printing. Dodd Camera stores are located in Cleveland, Dayton, Cincinnati, Chicago, and now Columbus in the Oak Creek Shopping Center on Cameron Avenue. If you don't have one in your town, you can find them online at doddcamera.com. At Dodd Camera, the focus is on you. Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Hello, welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. Tim McKenna is still off this week. He is due back for next week. We have a big show for you this week, so I'm not certain how much time we're going to have for news. There is, however, one news story we've been following for quite some time, and there has finally been a breakthrough. Earlier this week, and I'm going to quote from the story, officers from the New York Police Department's Collision Investigation Squad arrested a suspect in the hit-and-run killing of Matthew Von Ohlen, a Queens man who was fatally struck by the driver of a black Chevy Camaro while biking in a Williamsburg bike lane in July. The suspect, 56-year-old Juan Maldonado, resides in South Williamsburg. He was indicted in Brooklyn Supreme Court on 8 counts, including second-degree manslaughter, criminally negligent homicide, and leaving the scene of an accident. Bail was set at $100,000. Video surveillance recovered from the scene of the crash shows that the 35-year-old was riding in a designated bike lane when he was struck. Law enforcement sources told Pix 11 in July that the driver, who was shielded by tinted windows, may have struck Von Ohlen intentionally, slowing down and moving into the bike lane to strike him. The charges filed today, carrying a top sentence of 15 years, imply recklessness, not intentionality, which is kind of an interesting distinction. This was not an accident, said Acting District Attorney Eric Gonzalez, but rather a reckless act for which we intend to hold this defendant accountable. Von Ohlen was biking home from a shift as a bartender at a Pathique in Manhattan on the morning of July 2nd when he was struck in front of 690 Grand Street in Williamsburg between Manhattan and Graham Avenues. The crash took place around 2:20 a.m. The DA said Tuesday that, according to an investigation, Maldonado swerved into the bike lane on Grand Street and sped through a red light before striking Von Ohlen. Then he hit the victim's bicycle from behind, causing the victim to fall. The defendant continued driving, running over the victim and dragging him approximately 10 to 20 feet as he sped away. The last update on the Von Ohlen case came on July 6th, only 4 days after Von Ohlen's death. And at the time, the police identified the Camaro allegedly involved in the crash and confirmed that a suspect had been identified based on the vehicle's registration. But since then, there has been radio silence on the case and a marked uptick in cyclist ticketing on Grand Street, which has angered and puzzled Safe Street advocates. So far, it's exactly as it's been reported in Streets Blog. The New York Police Department source said Tuesday that DNA evidence has linked both Von Ohlen and Maldonado to the Camaro. So we're going to continue to watch the case as it goes to trial and see what punishment Mr. Maldonado actually faces. It's a maximum of 15 years right now. We'll see where it goes from there. So we're going to move on to the meat of our show. If you've been cycling for a very long time, you will remember the name Suntour and perhaps had a bike equipped with the componentry. Suntour made fabulous products back in the 70s and 80s. Sometime in the 80s, a shift, and shift is the operative here, occurred when Shimano perfected its index system, and Suntour struggled to keep up, eventually pretty much disappearing from the marketplace. This evening, Paul Brodick, who worked for Suntour USA and was in Japan to learn the language and the culture when he was recruited by Suntour in Asia, will walk us through the history of the story and help us to understand the dynamics of conflict that left Shimano victorious in the quest to take over the bicycle component market, which it has successfully done, as we all know. Later in the show, we're going to head on out to Tucson, Arizona, where Scott Casper has just landed and will be riding the El Tour de Tucson for JDRF, the Diabetes Research Foundation. Scott's son, Jake, who just turned 13, has type 1 diabetes, as does his older son. Jake just recently completed the 104-mile Amelia Island ride for JDRF. And Scott is also a USA cycling coach for the JDRF cycling group in his hometown in New Jersey. He's going to tell us about the foundation and the work that's going on to turn type 1 into type none, which is the goal. Let me introduce you now to Paul Brodick. We'll go back in time to hear the story of Suntour. Paul, thanks for joining me on the show this week.
Thanks for having me.
It's my pleasure. And unfortunately, I did not get to hear your talk in Philly, although it was on my radar and I really wanted to hear it. We had to actually work our table. So I really feel badly. But I think we can get to a lot of what you said in a conversation today one-on-one. So you get to present it all over again.
Excellent. Sounds great.
Okay. Give us a little bit of your background, and then we'll kind of sort of bring it forward to how you ended up doing this talk at the Philly Bike Expo.
Sure. Well, I started off in the bicycle business working at a small shop in New Jersey that was called Fuji Cycle Center of New Jersey. And the former owner was Ken Maria, who, while running the shop, was also managing Fuji America, which was located nearby in Oakland, New Jersey. And it was sort of an interesting time. This was around 1980 when I started working there, and Fuji America and Suntour USA and Shimano USA and Campagnolo USA were all located in New Jersey. Their U.S. headquarters were there. And the three component manufacturers, Suntour, Shimano, and Campagnolo, were probably within maybe a 15-mile radius in the same area in New Jersey. So it was interesting that there were all of these, both Fuji as a bicycle brand and then the three main component manufacturers in the U.S. market were all there in New Jersey, which is a little unusual. You'd think maybe they'd be in California where there was a bigger market, warmer weather, more dealers, and all of that.
Why do you think they picked New Jersey? I know it was a port of entry because everything ended up on the West Coast eventually.
Right. And, you know, it's an interesting question, and I don't really know the answer. I have a feeling that maybe for the two Japanese companies, they might have located in the New York area because that maybe was where their banks and insurance companies and, you know, other larger Japanese companies first located. But I don't really know the answer to that. And within probably a few years of when I started at the bike shop, Shimano moved most of their bicycle division to the West Coast, and Campagnolo, I think, did as well. They might have been out of Texas or eventually California, but, you know, there was definitely a movement towards California because the, you know, especially in the cycling industry, cycling in New Jersey was kind of seasonal. Not many shops were fully staffed year-round, and not many people were riding year-round, and California, I think, had a much larger share of dealers than a lot of year-round dealers, especially in the coastal areas.
So you didn't actually finish college at that time. You had decided to leave college and then go ahead and work in the bike shop. So tell us a little bit about that bike shop, because I have some information that's kind of interesting about it. You were actually doing all kinds of things that we don't think about in a bike shop, like chopping wood.
Right. Well, I was a senior at Rutgers University in New Brunswick, and I was spending a lot of time in the bike shop. And my reality was that my first semester senior year, I actually spent more time at the bike shop than I did in classes. And I was looking at not a very good academic result if I continued doing that. The shop was owned by a gentleman named Barrett Ladd, who's been a Trek rep for maybe 20 years now in the Allentown, Philadelphia area. Barry had bought the shop from Ken Maria, who again ran Fuji America, and he and his wife ran it, and they had no full-time employees. And so I decided that rather than fail out of school, I would take a leave of absence and work at the shop. And I was sort of an apprentice for the winter while I got enough skills to, you know, I felt deserved a salary. And then when springtime came, I was a full-time employee. And this was 1980, so Barry had a wood-burning stove, and that heated the store. And one of my jobs was to chop wood in the parking lot to get enough wood to stoke the stove so we would stay warm during the New Jersey winter. And Barry also had a frame building shop in the basement, so we had a frame table, and he had learned frame building from a friend of his named Bill Ralph, who had built for the Frazees at Park Cycle in Richfield Park. And New Jersey also had this kind of rich history with some very well-known people from big in bike racing and big in high-end bicycles that had shops in New Jersey. Frazier Park Cycle was one, and Jack Symes had a shop in Westwood, New Jersey called Westwood Cycle. The folks at Cops were also very involved with cycling. So there was a movement at that time where lots of people were starting to build frames. The Proteus Frame Building Manual had come out. Proteus was a bike shop in Maryland that did frame building and some frame building courses. And so there was this kind of burgeoning group of younger people who had started building frames. Some of them had been to Britain and done some apprenticeships there. And, you know, we were sort of part of that. We never actually got to build any frames, but I did some brazing and, you know, adding cable guides and things onto frames. And then I actually took a Proteus frame building course in spring of 81. Down in Maryland, so I built myself a frame at the Proteus Frame Building School.
You know, this is like taking me back so many years, because I got in the business in 1974, but then got interested in the pro end. So Proteus and the Frazees and all of Ken Mori, I mean, these are all names that are very familiar to me, may not be familiar to many of our listeners, but they certainly are sort of the hierarchy of bicycle culture at that time.
Right. Well, especially on the East Coast. I mean, there were things happening in Chicago, and there were things going on, you know, on the West Coast as well. But in our area, a lot of it happened to be concentrated in this New York metro area. And it was kind of odd, because with Suntour and Fuji America all, you know, within maybe a 50-mile radius of Manhattan, Fuji Cycle Center was in Rochelle Park, and Ridgewood Cycle was in Ridgewood, New Jersey, which was less than 10 miles away. And there was this sort of weird, incestuous hiring thing going on, where Fuji America was hiring a lot of people out of Ridgewood Cycle, and Suntour USA was hiring a lot of people out of Fuji Cycle. It was kind of like Ken didn't want to pull people out of the store he used to own, but there was this kind of cross-pollination. You know, everybody I worked with at Fuji Cycle, almost everybody eventually wind up working at Suntour USA, and I was working at Fuji America much later, and a number of the people there had been working at Ridgewood Cycle, so there was this kind of feeding frenzy of people leaving the bike shops and, you know, going to work for Fuji or for Suntour, which was kind of interesting as well.
Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Paul Brodeck. He has a rich and amazing history. We're going to get into some of the things that you may not know about Suntour USA. Certainly, they were at one time the leading Japanese brand from, if I am not mistaken, the JEX group, right?
Right. One of the issues was that Shimano had become larger than Suntour, and they were making a very wide range of products, and Suntour couldn't make all of those under one roof. So they allied with some other parts manufacturers in their area in Osaka and put together the JEX group. So they would have brakes and cranksets and pedals and headsets, be able to offer all of that to an OE, an original equipment bicycle manufacturer who's looking to spec a bicycle.
So let's not get too far ahead, because I want to talk a little bit about you and what you did. You actually learned Japanese. So did you go back to college?
Yeah, I spent a few years at the shop, and I realized that probably out of retail would be better for me, and I still wasn't sure whether I wanted to go into the business world or the world of academia, but either way, you know, I had to finish my undergraduate degree, and I was interested in Asia, and I realized I would have to pick a language, and it was either Japanese or Chinese at that point. Had I taken Chinese at the time, you know, within 4 or 5 years of deciding to take Japanese instead of Chinese, the bamboo wall came down, China opened up, you know, business flowed in, And Westerners who spoke Chinese and understood Chinese culture tended to very rapidly advance in the business world and, you know, do very well for themselves. And I studied Japanese instead. So if you had asked me in 1984, you know, which way to go, I would say Japan's the way to go. We had a product made in Taiwan that was not very good compared to Japanese product. And there was no product coming in from China. So, you know, it seemed like a good decision at the time. But things might have been different for me if I had chosen one over the other, Chinese instead of Japanese.
How interesting.
So I went back to school and I finished my degree. And I took 3 semesters of Japanese at Rutgers. And when I finished, I still wasn't sure if what I wanted to do, you know, academia or business. And I kind of realized that it would be difficult to decide to be involved with Japan, you know, for the rest of my professional career without ever having visited there. So I went to Japan and landed in Kyoto and spent my time full-time at a Japanese language school studying Japanese and then teaching English part-time to pay for my school lessons, and was still involved with bicycles and made friends with a couple of dealers in Kyoto who I'm still in touch with today.
I am talking with Paul Brodick. We're talking about SunTour and what happened to SunTour in the 80s when suddenly they were faced with a growing Shimano. Let's just put a little bit of backstory into it. What happened with SunTour and Shimano that led them to this unbelievable sort of fight?
Well, the first thing is, I mean, the interesting thing is that you look at both SunTour and Shimano, and through the 60s, I mean, SunTour started in 1922. Shimano probably started equally early. And up through the 60s, they made, you know, fairly low-end, very basic bicycle componentry. And as the oil shock hit and the bike boom took off, they went from almost no presence in the U.S. market to, you know, really dominance in terms of especially drivetrain components. All the dealer and actually department store mass merchant bikes in Japan as well. SunTour went from very little presence in the U.S. market to having more than a 50% share of product on all those bikes. SunTour for many years had a patent on the slant parallelogram derailleur, which was a design that allowed the derailleur to follow the contours of the freewheel better so that shifting was very quick and accurate. And arguably, they had the best shifting performance of any company for the 20 years that the patent was in effect. Mountain bikes came along in the early 80s, and there was a push to develop drivetrains that would shift wider range components better, drivetrains that would work well even when there was a lot of dirt and mud involved, and drivetrains that would work better under the kind of shock and abuse that mountain bikes take compared to what happens on road bikes. And initially, SunTour was very involved with that, and they were quicker than Shimano was at developing componentry for mountain bikes. They put together what they called a dirt ensemble, which was some of their touring componentry that was strengthened and redesigned to be a little bit more applicable for mountain bike. So they still had an upper hand, and then as the 80s went on, Shimano had been working with indexed componentry, clicks in the shift lever that would very accurately position the derailleur so that there was no guesswork in terms of where the gears were. After a few attempts that didn't work very well, they came up with DuraAce and with their 600-level, second from the top of the line, index componentry that worked very well. At SunTour USA, we had had some dealer seminars before the Interbike shows, and we had talked to the dealers about indexing, and most of the dealers were very negative about indexing. They didn't think that Shimano could make it work well. They didn't think it really belonged on bikes, and they basically said, you probably won't need indexing, but just in case it works, you better have something on the drawing board in case it happens. That was the summer of the key words were doesn't click, doesn't sell. And the Shimano road bikes that were indexed sold like crazy, and the SunTour bikes that had non-indexed componentry really didn't move at all. Dealers had a lot of excess inventory, and then dealers very quickly were saying, you have to give us indexing in the next product year as quickly as possible. So indexing became necessary, and it became necessary not just on the high end, but from the lowest end bikes all the way up to the highest end bikes. Shimano at the time had superior technology for indexing, and they had their technology locked up by patents that Suntour couldn't get around. Shimano was easy to set up, easy to maintain. It didn't change performance very much as components wore in, didn't need a lot of after service, and the Suntour system needed things very accurately spec'd. Frame alignment was critical. Using the right chains and cable and casing was critical. And even with all of that, when everything was sort of spot on spec, it really didn't work as well as Shimano's did. It was harder to set up. It went out of adjustment more often and, you know, was not as easy a system to live with. And as that went on for a couple of years, consumers voted with their wallets and they would do a parking lot test and the Shimano shifted better. And the Shimano bike sold very well and the Suntour equipped bikes did not sell as well. So Suntour started losing share on all those manufacturers' bikes, and you know, that sort of started to put the hurt to them because they weren't selling as much, not as much money was coming in, and they didn't have a quick answer to Shimano's superior performance.
Other than very pretty stuff. I mean, I don't think there was anything more beautiful than the Suntour Superb Group, period.
The lines were beautiful. The materials that were used, you know, the accuracy, the fit, the quality control, all of that was just really well done, beautiful lines.
But it didn't click well.
It didn't click as well, you know. One of the things I did in Japan was in marketing with catalogs and instruction manuals, and I rewrote a lot of the instruction manuals to be a little more linear in an American way. Japanese, you know, there's a lot of people talking about many Japanese instructions are hard to follow and instruction manuals don't make sense. And what I realized was that the Japanese assume that anyone who's going to be reading instructions for any kind of device is going to sit down and read them all the way through before they actually work on whatever it is. And in America, if we look at the instructions at all, we start at number one and we work through them all and do things one at a time. And the Japanese manuals always tended to be written, the sequence would be not linear. It would say, insert bolt A through hole B, attach with nut C. Before you attach nut C, make sure you insert washer D before you tighten it. So it was move forward, move back, you know, it wasn't very linear. And so I sort of was in a position to rewrite all of that and make it a little more understandable for U.S. dealers. So I understood how the Suntour equipment worked. When I had questions, I could run out to R&D and ask them, you know, how do you adjust this? How do you do that? I had all of those experts available to me there. And when I left Suntour, I went to work for Trek, and I was hastily assembling a staff and getting bikes ready for my first dealer show. And I couldn't find a lot of people from the bicycle industry, and I was the main mechanic. So I had to assemble all of these show bikes, 15, 20 bikes before the dealer show. And I figured that since I understood the Suntour componentry, I would start with the Shimano components, and I got out the Shimano instruction manuals, which weren't written as well as ours were. And I started with the cheapest possible bike, figuring that like Suntour, the cheap bikes wouldn't work as well as the high-end bike, so I'd get them out of the way first. And I read the manual, and I set up the cheapest bike. It had tourney or something on it. And son of a gun, it shifted perfectly in the stand the first time I set it up. And I couldn't make it misshift, and it just worked fine. And for kind of the first time, I understood how large a gap there was between what the Shimano components did for a dealer and what the Suntour components did. I had been on the Suntour dealers line long enough to know the dealers were complaining about how hard it was to set up, but, you know, I never really realized the reality of how much easier it was to work with the Shimano stuff. So the Shimano stuff went together really quick, and I got to the Suntour stuff, and it was a total pain in the neck and took forever to set up. And
wow,
it was pretty clear why things happened the way they did, you know?
So there was always this sort of story going around that one of the Shimanos said that before he died, he wanted to see Suntour buried. Is that a true story? Or is that BS?
I've never heard that.
Okay, I guess that's a bike shop, like, urban legend.
Well, it doesn't mean it's not true. It's something I haven't heard. I mean, it's sort of, there wasn't a lot of love lost between them.
Right.
And Shimano was definitely not as easygoing and pleasant as Suntour was in a way. They had an interest, of course, everyone had an interest in OE bike makers buying as much of this stuff as possible. Shimano was the one who said, if you buy a complete group, we can ship it really quick. If you decide you want to use someone else's brakes or someone else's chain or whatever, a delivery might not be quite as quick. So that was a subtle way of strong-arming people into only buying full Shimano group. When SRAM came on the market, they had a lot of difficulty getting their equipment spec'd on bikes because their OE customers would keep telling them that, I'd really love to use your shifters, but if I get your shifters, Shimano's going to delay my shipment. You know, my factory's not going to be able to build my bike. And they sued Shimano and won the case. And, you know, it was a restraint trade case that they sued in the U.S., brought in the U.S. And so Shimano definitely played hardball that way in a way that Suntour didn't. On the other hand, you know, there were engineers I knew in Japan who were very into old French componentry, and they had friends at Shimano who were into the same French componentry, and they would ride together and swap parts and stuff. So maybe at a lower level, there were employees who, you know, shared common interests and were sort of hanging out together. One of the engineers invited me to ride by Shimano on the way home to dumpster dive, because they would go into the dumpsters and try to, if there was anything interesting there that would, you know, give them a hint on what Shimano was working on. But I didn't take him up on it. So,
well, you know, we're running out of time, but this story is just so incredible. Are you going to somehow publish this in a book or something that people could read? There are so many people interested in the history of cycling, and this is a story that not many people have the kind of inside information that you do.
Well, there's not a lot of people who have the information. I'm not sure there's that many people interested in it.
Oh, I think there are. I respectfully disagree.
Yeah, you know, I'd like to put it together and maybe do some blogging, as most of the world does at this point. What happens is I'm still into, vintage isn't the right word. You know, when I started at Suntour, really all there were lugged steel frames. And while I was at Suntour, Cannondale came along and Klein came along and fat tube aluminum frames first hit the market. And very soon after that, I went to work for Trek, and suddenly there was fat tube welded aluminum, there was bonded aluminum, the old COV carbon frames came on. I was at Trek for about 10 years, and lots of new technology came. And I sort of stopped riding steel frames, and I was riding whatever, you know, some of the better Treks had. Had an OCLV carbon frame. I had some of the dual suspension mountain bikes. And then when I went to work for Fuji, they had a model called the Roubaix Pro, which was a Reynolds 753 skinny-tubed, more old-school steel frame. I was TIG welded, not lugged, but I went on a lunch ride on that. It's hard to describe, but it felt more right than any bike I had been on in like 10 years. And so I started riding steel again and getting rid of all the bikes I had with alternative materials. And so I sort of went from steel into the newer stuff and then back to steel. And now I'm kind of all about handmade steel frames.
Because steel is real.
Well, steel is real. You know, part of it is I like how it rides. Part of it is that when you buy a carbon frame, it's sheets of carbon laid up in a mold, and the mold dictates how the frame looks, and it does get painted. But when I looked at a lug frame, I see what the builder did. I see the choices that the builder made, the lugs that he or she used, how they're profiled. There's a lot of handwork there that you see, and it's both a technical thing about how it's built and how it rides, the fact that it's repairable. But it's also kind of an aesthetic thing because, you know, I like being able to see the file marks or to see the builder's ideas and the builder's touch and how the frame is made. So I've been involved with the steel bikes again, and I go to a lot of vintage bike events, the Classic Rendezvous list and the Cirques that have happened. And usually after a couple beers, we're sitting around and the Suntour tales come out, and so I've been thinking about them and relating the stories for a long time, but the Philly show was the first time I actually tried to put it all in context, put it all together, and, you know, do it in a more public forum. So,
well, I'm really glad that you did, because I think it's a story that many of us, even though we were involved very closely to the industry, never really understood how Shimano, I mean, we all knew that index shifting, even though we didn't like it at first, we knew there was just no denying how important it was to the, you know, transition into modern day cycling. But it was hard to say what really happened to Suntour and your knowledge of it. I think people would be interested. I'm going to encourage you to keep pursuing that.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Well, Paul, thank you so much for talking with me today. I hope we can talk again soon.
Thanks. Same here, Diane. Appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Paul Brodick joined me from his office in New Jersey. What a fascinating story. He remembers everything that goes back so far. I really enjoyed the conversation. We need to take a quick break. We actually have some time for news, and we'll be right back. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
Starting on November 19th and running till New Year's Day, Lake Metro Parks presents Candyland Has Gone Wild, the Wild Days of Winter Game, at Penitentiary Glen Reservation in Kirtland. Move along a life-sized game board in an indoor wonderland to discover the many flavors that nature offers. And be sure to check out special activities from 1 to 3 p.m. every Saturday afternoon throughout the exhibit schedule. Penitentiary Glen Reservation is located at 8668 Kirtland Chardon Road in Kirtland. More information at lakemetroparks.com. Click on events.
Hi there. We're back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and we do have time for just a couple, three news stories. This one comes from cyclingnews.com. BMC performance manager Alan Piper believes that Richie Porte can win the Tour de France and has confirmed that the Australian will lead the BMC team next July with the team built around him. So as you might remember, we spoke with Dan Worry last week, and he said, well, let's keep watching Chris Froome because he's really doing well. Well, Porte finished fifth in this year's Tour de France in his first season at BMC, following his move from Team Sky, and Piper believes he could have finished as high as second overall. Quote, this year we finished fifth in the Tour de France. Some bad luck happened on the first day, and we lost a minute and a half, which probably cost him second place. Also, with the crash with Chris Froome on Mont Ventoux, they lost time and all the rest of it, Piper told the Advocate newspaper in Porte's home state of Tasmania during a winter visit to Australia. The big thing for me is that as a team, we now know and we believe that he can win the Tour de France. If you can finish second, you can finish first. So I guess we're going to be watching to see if that is true. It's certainly an interesting story, and we will. We'll find out, I guess, next July. This is a story about the Dutch Reach. You might remember my conversation with Dr. Michael Charney, who talks about getting out of your car using your right hand if you're a driver and your left hand if you're a passenger, so that you're forced to turn around and look behind you and not door somebody. Well, it looks like Canada has decided to pick up on the idea, and they made a YouTube video. You can go to dutchreach.org/breaking news. It's about a 4-minute video about cycling safety, and the Dutch Reach is included. It's really, really nice. dutchreach.org. You know, we don't report a lot about mountain biking, and I'm sorry we don't, because there's a lot going on. And this comes out of Wind Rock Park in Oliver Springs, Tennessee. Wind Rock Park is opening a new uplift-assisted mountain bike park. The bike park features 9 trails, including a new flow trail and improved intermediate terrain. The terrain at Wind Rock Park is amazing, and anyone who has ridden the mountain bike trails can see that the potential has always been huge, said Nico Mullally, professional mountain bike rider, who, along with fellow pro bike rider Sean Leader, designed and built the park. So the bike park is laid out on 550 acres. It's nestled in the Cumberland Mountains on the Wind Rock Park's property, which is a total of 72,000 acres. The park includes 9 trails ranging from 1 mile to 1.5 mile long each, dropping 1,100 vertical feet and taking an average of 5 to 10 minutes to complete. There are connector trails to give the riders the option to combine trails. That sounds like an interesting design. And they say they've designed the bike park to best utilize the natural terrain of the mountain. We improved the existing trails to add flow and added new trails to put together a really fun layout. So if you are interested, you can go to windrockbikepark.com. So that's all I've got in news. We need to run out to Tucson, Arizona and talk with Scott Casper about El Tour de Tucson and his role as a cycling coach for JDRF. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
We'd like to thank our podcast sponsor, Dodd Camera, for their support of The Outspoken Cyclist. There is a close relationship between cycling and photography, and we're proud to have this family-owned business as a partner in our show. If you're in the market for photo equipment, want to learn more about taking great pictures, or maybe you're ready to launch your own YouTube channel, visit doddcamera.com and see what Dodd Camera can do for you.
Hi there. We're back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. We're going to head on out to Tucson, Arizona, where Scott Casper has just landed. And we'll be riding the El Tour de Tucson for JDRF, the Diabetes Research Foundation. Hi, Scott. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me this afternoon. How's Arizona?
Oh, it's fantastic, Diane. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. So you and your family are going to be doing El Tour de Tucson this weekend. It's a ride that's always interested me because they have great posters.
Yeah, they do. It's a fantastic ride. I've done El Tour de Tucson before. I'm thrilled to be back here, and it's fantastic to be doing this with JDRF. It's such an important cause.
That's what we're going to talk about. My husband just did a JDRF ride with a group from Cleveland. They did the Hincapie. I know that a group did, and including your son and you, did the Amelia Island group. Tell us about JDRF, what your role is and your relationship to type 1 diabetes and everything that is happening on behalf of what you're doing at El Tour de Tucson.
Sure. So we have about 3 hours to talk. That's a huge question. So I'll condense it to this. So my connection to JDRF is that diabetes has a significant impact in my family. I have 3 sons, my oldest son and my youngest son both have type 1 diabetes. My wife's sister has type 1 diabetes, and my mother has type 1 diabetes. And my wife's first cousin, Zach, has type 1 diabetes. So from a family perspective, it's very important for us to find a cure. And we as a family got involved in JDRF shortly after my son Jake was diagnosed 13 years ago. I was very heavily involved in our local chapter. I live in South Jersey. I've been on the board of the South Jersey chapter for close to 10 years. I was the chapter president for several years. And somewhere along the way, I learned about this thing called JDRF Ride to Cure. I was actually challenged to complete JDRF Ride to Cure back in 2011. And I didn't know anything about it at the time. So I went and did, my very first ride was the JDRF Ride to Cure in Lake Tahoe in 2011. I did it with my wife, Rachel. And the funny thing about JDRF Ride to Cure is it's a sort of a life-changing experience. It's not your typical bike ride. It's not your typical charity ride. I don't know how to really describe it to your listeners on a radio show other than to say it's an epic weekend. And it changes people's lives. And so I had my first experience as a rider. I had several people on that ride who really helped me through to be successful in that ride. And those are folks within the Ride to Cure that are called coaches. Unlike a lot of other charity bike rides, JDRF Ride to Cure offers USA Cycling certified coaches to the riders who register and sign up to help them develop a training plan and meet their training goals and do all those things. And so I decided after that first ride that I had to give back to the people that helped me, and I became a USA-certified cycling coach. I've been a JDRF Ride to Cure coach ever since 2012. We've grown our team in South Jersey, and in fact, the JDRF Ride to Cure has grown significantly. And my role now is to help people sort of have that unbelievably unique, epic, life-changing experience while at the same time they raise a ton of money to be dedicated to JDRF's mission of finding a cure for type 1 diabetes and creating a world without the risks and the concerns and the fears and the impacts of this disease.
So that was a lot, and I want to break some of it down. The first thing I would like to break down, because I don't personally have anybody in my immediate life who has diabetes. So I want to understand there's type 1, which we want to have now come to type none. That is the goal, that there won't be any ever. And there is something else. Type 1 is juvenile diabetes. Is that correct?
So you just asked me a fantastic question, because it really helps dispel some of the myths about type 1 diabetes. We used to call type 1 diabetes juvenile diabetes. We used to call it that. And we don't call it that anymore. JDRF still has that J in its name. But in fact, several years ago, JDRF abandoned its formal name, the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation, and is just now called JDRF. And the reason for that is because type 1 diabetes hits people at all ages. My mom, in fact, was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes in her late 50s. My son was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes at the age of 13 months old. So as you can see, it impacts people at all ages. And so we've abandoned the notion that it's juvenile diabetes. It's not. In fact, more and more adults are being diagnosed with type 1 diabetes now than ever before. So it's something that we can distinguish from type 2 diabetes, but we no longer sort of refer to the juvenile onset and adult onset diabetes. Does that make sense to you?
It does. It makes absolutely sense to me. But I guess my question would be what the difference is between type 1 and type 2. So how are they characterized?
Type 1 diabetes is an autoimmune disease. A normal person's body makes insulin in the pancreas. In a person who has type 1 diabetes, their autoimmune system attacks the pancreas, attacks the insulin-producing beta cells in the pancreas, and kills those cells so that someone with type 1 diabetes no longer has the ability to produce insulin on their own. Insulin, when you eat, is the hormone that regulates your body's ability to absorb the sugar, the glucose, that's metabolized from the food that you eat. So without insulin, you cannot get the nutrients that you need to make your body function, to make your brain work, and to make your body function normally. So people with type 1 diabetes have to inject insulin in order to make that happen. Without insulin, they will die.
Okay.
Type 1 diabetes, it has immediate life-threatening components to it, because insulin in and of itself is a dangerous drug. You need insulin in order to absorb those nutrients that I just described, but too much insulin can cause your blood sugar to go so low that you end up in a diabetic coma and potentially death. So it's a very fine line. Folks with type 1 diabetes walk a wire every single day of regulating their blood sugar and regulating their insulin intake. Contrast that with type 2 diabetes. Type 2 diabetes has multiple components that can cause it, some of which can be solved, cured, if you will, with controlling diet, regulating exercise, oral medications that can control blood sugar. People with type 2 diabetes, they do produce insulin. Their body has a challenge using the insulin that their body produces. And so certain medications can help them to use that insulin and absorb the metabolized sugars more readily. It's a very, very different disease. Quite honestly, the two diseases have very little in common other than the fact that the word diabetes is in their name.
And insulin is part of it.
Well, and insulin is part of it at times. But certainly for type 1 diabetes, it's an autoimmune disease. There is no cure. It can impact you in the early stages of your life, in the later stages of your life, in the middle stages of your life. Diet and exercise will do nothing to either cure or prevent this. So I used to have people say to me about my two sons, oh, they're so skinny, how did they get diabetes? You know, that's a myth that, you know, obesity and people who are overweight can cause type 2 diabetes. It has no relationship to type 1 diabetes whatsoever. And folks with type 1 diabetes can eat whatever they want.
Right.
They just need to take insulin in order to do that. So they're very different diseases that are managed very differently. And as you mentioned earlier, JDRF is working very hard to create a world without type 1 diabetes, to create type none. And you know, we need a cure.
Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Scott Kasper. He is out in Tucson getting ready to ride with his two sons for sure, or three. Are all three riding?
Two of my sons ride. My third son does not. He's off in college studying real hard. I'd rather have him study than ride right now. That's more important.
Right.
So my son Ryan, who's my middle son, who does not have type 1 diabetes, Ryan and I rode in the JDRF Ride to Cure in Burlington, Vermont in July. And then my youngest son Jake, as you mentioned, rode in the Amelia Island ride last month. So I'm out here with 200 other riders from JDRF, but my sons are back home.
You know, that's a really big number. I know when the group from Northeast Ohio went to Hincapie, I realized that these rides are huge and that you usually hook on to another ride and you're your own sort of group. I know JDRF down in South Carolina were applauded just enormously for the work that they're doing to raise funds for this research. It's amazing.
Yeah. I appreciate you saying that. You know, there's two models for the rides that we do. There are several rides that are JDRF-only rides. Amelia Island, for example, was only JDRF. We had more than 700 riders in Amelia Island the last weekend in October.
Wow.
That ride raised approximately $3 million. And then some of our other rides, such as the one you mentioned, the Hincapie Grand Fondo, El Tour de Tucson, where I am right now, and the Tour de Tahoe in Lake Tahoe are rides that we piggyback onto pre-existing, large, organized, destination-type rides that are very attractive for people to come and participate in. And that's a draw, quite frankly, to get people to sign up for this. The JDRF Ride to Cure model, though, is very interesting compared to other charity bike rides where you sort of pay a registration fee and you may or may not have to fundraise. The JDRF Ride to Cure has a very high threshold for fundraising. In order to participate, you have to raise at a minimum of $2,000. The average rider in the JDRF Ride to Cure, we have almost 2,000 riders this year. The average rider raises a little bit more than $4,000. I don't know a whole lot about the other charity bike rides that are out there, but I'm fairly certain that the average rider doesn't come close to raising, you know, over $4,000. And so I like to say this, we're small but mighty.
Well, I have been sort of railing against, and I hate to use that word, these rides that say go out and hit your friends up for $25 here or $10 a mile or whatever it is. The fact that you have a threshold that people know right up front what it's going to be,
right,
shows a commitment that people will not only make that, you know, write that check if they have to, but they're also going to show up. And I think that's really interesting. You know, the people don't shrink from this ride. They will show up.
Well, they show up and they show up in force. And that's part of when I said it's an epic weekend. When I go down to dinner this evening, there'll be 200 riders plus some volunteers and staff plus some family members. There'll probably be, you know, 350 or 400 people at the dinner this evening. And the energy in that room will be palpable. The fact that these 200 riders and their friends and family come together for this common cause that impacts every single one of us. And many of those people themselves will have type 1 diabetes. Many of our riders have type 1 diabetes. The fact that we are all here together creates a family like I've never experienced before. I will tell you that I mentioned my first ride was in 2011. Some of my best friends right now in the world are people that I met at that ride in 2011, who I remain in touch with on a very regular basis. And the bond that we share for having done this is almost indescribable. I would really encourage anyone who wants to get involved in a mission-oriented ride like this to really get involved. And one of the things we tell people, Diane, you talked about, you know, that you hit people up for the 25 bucks here and there, and then you may not even show up. We have this sort of motto with the Ride to Cure that it's not about the miles, it's about the mission. And our mission is to raise the money to fund the research to find a cure. we've all done that. So the people who are arriving in Tucson today for Saturday's ride have already completed their fundraising. And so now it's about the celebration of that. And to celebrate the fact that we just raised all that money, this ride in Tucson, I believe the 200 riders right now have raised somewhere between $600,000 and $700,000, which is a huge amount of money for 200 people.
That's a respectable number, yeah, I'd say so.
And so what we're going to do on Saturday is we're going to celebrate by riding our bikes in this phenomenal ride in this beautiful place. It's going to be a great experience, but the mission is accomplished. We've raised the money. And I think that is what differentiates from some of those other charity rides, which I do. I do a lot of charity rides, and they're wonderful. But they're sort of, you show up for the day, you ride your bike, you go home. And there's not a lot that's vested in that. It's not the same type of moving experience that people have when they come here to spend 4 days with people who are on the same mission that you are and have the same mindset that you do. And let me tell you, some of these people are Ironman triathletes. And some of these people are weekend warriors who just went out and bought their first bike and are not going to do 106 miles on Saturday. They're going to do 40. And they're going to be darn proud of the fact that they muscled out 40 miles because they're not athletes. But they join this mission. They do this ride. They become cyclists, even if they're not right now. And it changes their lives. It really, really changes their lives. And I can't say enough about that aspect of this.
Let me ask you a question before we wrap up this conversation. You can get back to your group and you can go get ready for this epic ride. Are there any breakthroughs that you see coming in research? You know, you start looking at things like DNA and genetic modification and stem cell and all that. What kinds of research is being done? And do you see anything like on the horizon?
Gosh, that's such a great question. And listen, part of the reason that I'm able to raise as much money as we raise as a family is because I relate back to our donors. Here's what your money is doing. You're not just writing a check that's going into an abyss. JDRF is really moving the ball forward on this pipeline to a cure. The first thing I think that's important to mention is a recent development within the last month or so. The FDA has approved what's known as the artificial pancreas. So this is a device that involves an insulin pump. It involves a continuous glucose monitor. And it involves a computer algorithm that connects those two things so that it becomes completely automated. It measures someone's blood sugar and then gives them insulin when they need it so that their blood sugar doesn't go too high. And it shuts off the insulin pump when their blood sugar goes too low. And the whole point is to, therefore, allow someone with type 1 diabetes to live a much more normal life without the fear and concern and frustration and complications that are caused by constantly having to manage both high and low blood sugars and giving insulin after you eat and all of those types of things. So it's completely automated. It's not a cure, though.
Does that mean that people don't have to test either?
That's correct.
That's so interesting because I know that's a lot of the issue. My husband has cousins, one of whom was very resistant to all of the things she had to do as a young child. You know, it's in trial or is it real yet?
No, this is real. This has been, the trials have been concluded. It's been approved by the FDA for commercial use. The first company bringing it to market is sending the devices out to their customers now. So there are people who are using this device today. And so that's the first very real thing. There are other things that are in the pipeline, though, right now as well, such as encapsulation, which is early in our conversation, I talked to you about the insulin-producing beta cells and the body's autoimmune response that kills those cells. Well, what encapsulation does is takes those cells, implants them into a small device about the size of a Band-Aid, and that device becomes immunoprotective to those cells. And it is implanted under the skin. And those cells that are implanted in that device then begin to produce their own insulin in reaction to glucose in the bloodstream. So it really is much closer to a true artificial pancreas in that it requires no intervention whatsoever. It's implanted once, it will last for some period of time. They're trying to figure this out right now, how long it will remain implanted before it needs to be changed out. But when it is implanted, the patient who has that implanted will become completely insulin-free, will not have to check blood sugar. So it's a very minor sort of outpatient, minor surgical procedure to put that in, and then you're worry-free for 6 months or a year or however long the clinical trials that are underway right now will determine that it's safe and effective to leave in there before it's swapped out. So that's something that's in the pipeline as well. And then a third thing that I'll mention is something called smart insulin. This is insulin that gets injected on a daily basis or but is inert unless it's in the presence of glucose in the bloodstream, in which case it reacts with that glucose and processes that glucose like normal insulin would. And if there is no free-floating glucose in the bloodstream, you end up excreting that that smart insulin out. So you take a big bolus of it at the beginning of the day. Your body uses what it needs to use and excretes out the other stuff. And once again, the person no longer has to worry about checking blood sugar constantly or giving insulin after they eat every time or any of those things. Blood sugar ranges become much more controlled. The worry, the fear, the anxiety of high and low blood sugars go away. So these are some things that, although they're not the biological cure for the disease, will help make the disease much more manageable, will help keep our friends and family with type 1 diabetes healthier as we progress down the path to the actual cure. And that's a very important point, Diane, because what we know is when that cure is found at some point in the future, the folks with type 1 diabetes today have to be healthy enough to be able to benefit from that cure. So to keep folks living longer and living healthier with fewer complications is really the goal right now, while at the same time spending a significant amount of time, money, research, and effort on ultimately that biological cure. And the challenge with that is we still don't know what causes the autoimmune response in the first place. So while we're looking for those reasons, you know, there's a whole lot of work going on in order to improve the lives of the people today. So that's what JDRF is doing right now. That's why the money is so important. That's why we're raising so much money. And it's just right now, as I said to you before, is a very exciting time because so much of this stuff is happening and getting approved by the FDA in a rapid fashion, much more faster than ever before.
Well, you are one hell of a spokesperson for this disease. I want to say thank you for taking the time to tell us about it. I'm not sure people understand diabetes. I think a lot of people think they bring it on themselves. And your explanation of the sort of genetic part of it that, you know, there are two types and one is not controllable with just diet, that you absolutely have to monitor it and do the things you have to do. You know, I think people have a different view of it after our conversation. So thank you very much.
If your show can help us do that, then we've moved the ball forward with education and awareness, and that's great too.
Well, I hope it does. And thanks so much. Have a lot of fun riding this weekend. Keep up the great work. It's wonderful to talk with you.
Likewise. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Scott Casper joined me from Tucson, Arizona, where he is about to participate in the El Tour de Tucson. When you hear this, this ride will already be over. We caught him on Thursday, and I really appreciate him taking time to talk with me. I know he's got lots of things going on right now out in Tucson for the JDRF group, who's with him, all 200 of them. So that's our show for this week. I'd like to thank our guests, Paul Brodick, Scott Casper. We'll be back next week with a brand new show. We're going to be talking with Guy Andrews, whose new book, Yellow Jersey Racer, all about Greg LeMond, is on the schedule, along with a couple surprises. Hope you have a wonderful Thanksgiving. Thank you so much for listening. If you have a chance and the weather's good, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next week at this same time with more conversation and news from the world of cycling. If you missed any part of today's show, download the podcast from iTunes or WJCU.org. And you can follow the Outspoken Cyclist on Facebook and Twitter to keep the conversation going throughout the week. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.